Now, before I go into more detail about that type of data, and I'm going to go into a lot of that data because I think it's generally ignored by people who look at polysemy, let's say, from lexical semantic traditions in the United States, for example, Levine and Rappaport and Fillmore, that tradition focuses on the verb, which is a very good place to focus because that's where you have argument specification. However, the fact is, as has been pointed out a great deal by a number of people, the way that you characterize the parameter structure of the functor, the traditional functor, the functional element such as a verb or an adjective, is actually very much in communication with the information associated with the argument it's applying to. And so it so happens that the arguments, which are typically noun phrases, have a lot more relational and argument structure of their own that has not been characterized. Before I get to that, let's just look at the basic mechanisms of the type system. It's work that has been developed on and off with my colleague Nicholas Asher and published in a couple of places. This is something, the general outline of this, the material in this lecture is coming out in the spring in a book of mine from MIT Press. The type language that I will assume is the general system that we would take from the functional system of types of Montague, just to start off with. But what you see immediately is that there are too few entity types. Okay? So what we want to do is something that would be similar to what has been done within the LKB, the original Aquilex work done, say, at University of Cambridge, using the type feature structure logics of, let's say, Carpenter or Casper and Rounds, where you create a rich ontology of types that have a particular ordering, and you can refer to those as types in the selection that you might create of the specification of a verb meaning, for example, or for whatever other purpose you might want to use it for, let's say a web agent of some sort. But the fact is that you have a much richer system of types, and from the argument that I was presenting on Monday, they may underlyingly be predicates, right? But we treat them as types because they are pretests on the satisfaction of whether this argument should actually then be lambded in to a predicate, okay? So we're treating them differently, but in fact, it's a matter of optimization, all right? And if you have questions about that, then we have to revisit some of the material from Monday. We can talk about that later. So there's simple types, which are basically E and T, and whatever the sorts under that would be. Then you have a functional type, which is just like an intransitive verb that we talked about. But then I have two operators. They're type constructors. I have a dot, which is a product type from classic GL 95, and something that is a tensor, which is very much like the linear logic with, if you're familiar with linear logic, but it doesn't have the same rules associated with it. This is going to be the way to characterize qualia information. Okay? Let me show how. So the type feature structure, get this a little larger. This is a classic treatment of the qualia within gender lexicon. I have an individual, this is specified as some predicate or some type. That type actually is its formal specification. It may have come about by some activity, sigma. It may be for, the purpose might be tau. And there may be some constitution, beta. Okay? As I said before, not all of these things have to be present for any concept, for any lexical item and the concept associated with that. So I'm going to reframe this as types, I'm kind of linearizing it a bit, in order to be able to then appeal to some very standard, well-understood rules of introduction and elimination in natural deduction, in logic. So that's going to allow me to at least test the waters for how closely can we model our expressions, these rich expressions, not just your basic first-order logic or your basic simply typed lambda calculus. No, rather GL expressions, and see if they can actually map to types which then behave in a very formal, predictable, and understandable way in a proof theory, a natural deduction, some kind of Gensen derivation, if you're familiar with that kind of stuff. So I'm basically linearizing things. I've gotten rid of formal because really it was redundant. So the formal is still there, but it's actually the head type, okay? Which is good because we still have a notion of a formal role, okay? Don't say that it's gone. It's just that it's actually become even more important. Now I have the ability to refer to the constitution of something, if it exists, in my explanation of a concept, okay? So, for example, something like water may have beta and alpha identical. They may not differ at all until I quantify and package the water, okay? Grinding operations, if you're familiar with grinding operations of Pelletier, would be to bring about a realization of the constitutive. And creating the constitutive is actually the formal. They're going to be the head type. We're going to look at some of those later. This telos is a modal operator saying, well, you can do tau. You're 4 tau. You don't have to be tau, but you could be. Okay? It's not a diamond operator because it doesn't have the same semantics of diamond in modal logic. But it's very similar to it. It's more associated with the semantics of intentionality, which we really don't understand as well. But that, with that caveat, you don't want to have it exactly behave like a diamond. This is existential. This is a Skolemized event. This thing happened, okay, to bring about this guy. So it's kind of an operator that says, oh, you came about because of process sigma. All right? I'll show you how. So the first thing that we did after talking about methodology on Monday was to come up with this distinction, this notion that natural kinds are in fact not just for philosophers and psychologists and metaphysicians, but in fact are for linguists. For linguists as a privileged linguistic entity, a type. And that said, that, given also then the principle of functional typing, gives rise, without even any further stipulation, that there must be natural predicates and natural adjectives. In fact, you might even think, although it's perhaps maybe a little bit more dubious, you might think that there are natural propositions, propositions which are really asserting only something about natural entities. In fact, there's a correlation between natural predication and application over natural entities and very presuppositionless propositions. Okay, so we'll talk about that if you have any comments about that. I won't have time to get to that. So the thing about natural entities, which is very nice, is that they form a tree. It's a taxonomic structure. So within an ontology, if you can't fit something into a tree, then you haven't done it right, according to this system. Okay? This is a joined semilattice, and it's not going to, that's all it is. So you've got physical, human, stick, lion, pebble, and you've got, let's say, water, sky, rock. You can quantify rock. Now, this is not to say that there aren't transformations which take you from water to bits of water, packages of water, or from rock to individual rocks, okay? And in fact, those concepts may be split in language one versus language two. So this is not entirely pre-lingual, pre-linguistic, but it's going with the data. And that this is going to be one of the things that we, when we confront the corpus of any particular language, li, l sub I, we're going to hit smack against such rocks, no pun intended, because it will not accord to my theory. So what do I do? Well, if you're a theoretical linguist, you ignore those data. If you're a corpus linguist, you got to confront the data. And you say, whoa, I got to change my theory. So essentially we get something that might be a type lattice. So I have physical, individuated, animate things, and they're going to obey inheritance, and I'm going to have a rule which does unification, very much like unification in feature-based unification grammars. I'm going up and down because some of the fonts are quite small, so I'm actually kind of going away from the normal Adobe PDF. So natural predicates, which are then formed with these guys as their arguments. For example, if fall is a verb and is a a functional type, then it actually, if it takes natural objects, then it too becomes a natural predicate. Similarly, touch is a relationship between individuals which are physical in their manifestation, except for metaphorical interpretations. Clearly, there's always going to be some counterexamples to this. I'm trying to come up with an idealization, a simple model, an approximation, as it were, if I wanted to think of these as statistical models. Similarly, under, okay, in between might also be, but it has three arguments. Now, expressed as lambda, expressing these typed expressions as lambda expressions, then I see that in 69, I've typed an argument, so I have the specification of the argument, I give its type environment, and I give, bless you, what might be the semantics of that expression. Okay? Any questions on this so far? Pretty straightforward. You don't have anything to really ask, because why haven't made any claims yet? What's the consequences of this? Well, the first consequence is that not everything is natural. We know that, particularly in the United States, most things are artificial. Entities formed from naturals by adding something else. Now, the notion of an artifact studying the notion of an artifact has a long tradition in ethics, or in essentially in aesthetics, theory of aesthetics, all the way back, particularly in Kant and before Kant. But the idea is actually quite developed within these frameworks that artifacts encode two very special things, which we've completely ignored in semantics. Two very special things. One is that they're made by virtue of our doing something to the world. So we bring about something new. Okay, well, we've studied notions of resultatives and certainly the notion of change in verbal semantics, but this is something that's an entity. The entity essentially, such as a watch, a table, a cup of coffee, whatever, they're resultative objects. They're the result of some process, some sort of activity. They started off as natural, perhaps. Maybe you make something artificial, then you take that, and you make something else, and so on and so forth. And you don't typically just make stuff. You make it for a purpose. The other thing that aesthetic theory, has made a real point of is that there's intentionality. Now, we would like to combine intentionality with the fact that it's been made. So I've got kind of two parameters here. But by the way, these ideas are in kind of classic generative lexicon, but they're much less constrained in terms of the way they project to language. I'm trying to constrain this in a slightly tighter way. So to get to the chase, I would like to have a way of expressing this as a type. So I've got some object. I'm going to type it as a natural that has been operated on. Okay? So this actually is kind of the result of an event. If I were to look at an event structure, or if you're familiar with dynamic logics, I would perform some activity. So I'll use black for highest visibility. So in comes some natural type. I perform some operation, sigma, and then I output something, which is the actual artifact itself. Okay, and that's the thing that this, and what if you know dynamic logic from programming semantics? Anybody familiar with this? The problem with that, taking that information, that kind of model for linguistics, for language, is that what do I type an argument? I don't know. How do I actually create a lambda calculus for this? It's very unintuitive, and it becomes quite complicated. What here I'm saying is, it's quite simple. Use the type operator to encode that information, say, oh, This actually is the type of the changed object. X exists because of the event S. Separately, I can take something and give it a purpose. So I can go and find a stick and say, this is the stick I'm going to use for process P. It could be for stirring my coffee, for hitting trees, for getting ants, if you're a monkey, whatever it might be. It has now a function. I've given it purpose. But those are two extremes that are typically combined. And the default case, so what I just mentioned was the purpose of X is tau. Now, this is a different semantics associated with it, because this is modal. This is not modal, as I mentioned before. So the semantics we give to these has to be distinct. But that's always the case in when you've got feature structures as well. And the feature structures for the agentive and the telic and for other models like this, they have to have different semantics for these. Okay, one has to be modal in type, and the other one has to be existential. To make this purely syntactic, I would actually want to have the introduction of a different layer of typing, which I'm not going to be able to get into today. Now, put them together, and I get basically the default artifactual entity, which is, I take this guy that I've made, and I give it some purpose. Okay? I make some stuff, and then I drink it. Okay? So it started off as water and some ground coffee, but then I do something to it, and I get the liquid coffee that I'm going to drink. Okay? Is this straightforward? Any questions? Now, so we can look at, I'm not going to look at the full detail of all these when I give the examples, because it just gets too messy in terms of writing out the formulas. So examples of these would be beer, which is some liquid that I use for drinking. Okay? If you want to have an additional telos, an additional purpose, you could chain them, right? How would you differentiate artificial beverages? So you have a notion of a potable, right? In your ontology, you've got a potable liquid, and potable meaning drinkable, and you define the potables because it's important to you. You need to, okay? Your web system, your language system, your machine translation system, whatever you're doing, okay? And this always has to be dependent on why are you doing this to begin with? Why do you need this information? You're going to have milk, okay? Which is not just pure milk, okay? You do have pure milk, but you're going to get sick if you drink that. You have beer, you have coffee, you have, you know, vodka, you have absinthe, whatever you might have. What are the purposes for drinking alcoholic beverages versus stimulant beverages? Well, I just gave another telos to that classification. I said stimulant. Alcoholic is not a telos. It's a characterization that we associate with a particular telos, to relax, to get drunk, whatever it might be. And those can be further differentiated. I'm not going into that right now. That will follow. That type of classification will follow. Massimo? Yeah, please.
So you already have there two types for beer, and I was thinking maybe one could have more if you want to have.
Yeah, this is kind of an elaborate view of what this is kind of hiding. Okay.
Oh, I see. So there's another. Well, okay. So my question was going to be, I could think of other types, like you want to say, well, beer is made as a certain constituent of other things. So I was wondering.
That's true. It could be a constituent of a beer. Battered shrimp or something like that.
Yeah, so food or. But so do you? How does in this new version you still? Those are all types which are part of the lexical entry for beer, or are those new? These types that you're proposing there are somehow alternative to what?
Alternative to what?
Well, so in as I understand it, the original theory you had for say. Beer, you would have, you know, constitutive, and those were all different types, right?
They're all different types, and then the feature structure brings them together.
That's
and
right.
The feature structure itself is a type. It's a type feature structure.
And so this is still the same assumption?
Same idea, assumption, okay. And that's a good point to clarify. It's the same idea, but I'm linearizing it and bringing it out like this so that I can look at specific rules of introduction and exploitation and elimination, okay? Which are hard to do. You can do them in type feature structures, but they become much more arbitrary and much more difficult to look at the properties of. Any other questions? So, just to be clear, this is just a more elaborate or verbose version of this, because what you're going to see in my examples later on are the first ones, okay? Because I just don't care about the others. In fact, there's even a constitutive. I don't care about the constitutive right now, because it's not relevant to the points I'm making. But Massimo's right. All the features are there as types. We can also look at humans, not as artifacts. Oh, we're all artifacts, but that's boring. We are, as anthropomorphizing our projection of intentionality to the world, taking that as a default. So if I make it a non-default, then it becomes kind of marked. So cloning or genetically modified X, okay? You have to have a new word for it. So it's outside the default. Okay, it's a marked case. So agentive on natural objects is just given. You can specify it. It's there, but the default is that it's made by natural selection, transcendent being above whom we all adore, whatever it might be, okay? Take your philosophy. Now, to give function to an individual that's a natural kind brings up new concepts. If I give a particular function to my somewhat artificially bred standard poodle, Otis, then I have a pet. Okay? I can take a natural coyote from the wild, try to make that a pet. I'm taking a truly natural entity, the coyote, and adopting it and trying to tame it for it to be my pet. I'm applying a function to it. I have socially, and this is kind of inspired by Searle's notion of the social web that we have from his 1995 book, we have a social construction, which is really what we mediate with other people through. So my notion of a boss, a friend, and dancers, they're all essentially layered constructions. A dancer, my boss, my friend, my wife, my husband, they're not natural. They're functional classifications. They have to be characterized as classifications. But the important thing is, just as in the feature structure representation, I have ready access to someone being human, someone being human here, okay? Because husbands are going to die. You're going to touch dancers and wives and husbands. You need to be able to refer to the predicates that are, in fact, natural in kind. Well, here's the first kind of break from classic type theory. Because classic type theory can say, oh, yeah, sure, everything's natural. You predicate it, okay? But here's where things actually get a little different. Because of the principle of functional typing, you have artifactual predicates. So the fact is, and this is what we're going to see in the corpus, not only do you have these normal kind of everyday coercions and type shiftings and grindings and packagings that I think we're all pretty comfortable with now in the community since it's been studied for like 45 years now, you have a lot of other things going on that have not been noticed as coercions. And the point is going to be the failure to notice that has profound consequences on creating lexical sets to do clustering and induction of the argument type that you want for a verb. So it has consequences for the way that you do semantic induction using statistical techniques. I'll get to that tomorrow. But we're just going to, I'm kind of sowing the first seeds. So spoil is a predicate, as in the beer spoiled, the milk spoiled, the meat spoiled, which has some illusion, a presupposition, just think of them as presuppositions, of a use for this thing, okay? You can't have dirt spoil unless you wanted to use that dirt for your Japanese sand garden, okay? Or the water spoiled, you were going to use it for whatever, baking or for some nuclear experiment. So then expressing these as lambda expressions, you can see where I'm going. I'm asking for a certain type. And if you're not going to be that type, you're going to get coerced, okay? So it's the same thing as in, I've got some noun phrase, you're not a mass term, I can coerce you to a mass term, okay? There's John all over the highway, the classic David Lewis example. People familiar with packaging and grinding operations? Okay. Now, the third type, which is even more controversial, although some formal semanticists are now modeling this in a way very similar to this. I'm thinking of Robin Cooper's recent work on record types, and Mark Johnson to a certain extent, is something called a complex entity or a dot object. And I mentioned this informally before. Entities formed from the naturals and artifactuals by a product type between the entities, which I'm going to call a dot. So I gave the first example of book, which people have been hearing me talk about for 15 years, probably. We're going to go into some excruciating detail of how actually prevalent such objects are in language. And this is just English. So John wrote the exam last night. The exam lasted more than 3 hours. So the writing of the exam took 8 minutes. The exam lasted more than 3 hours. So it's an event, and it's some informational object. Okay, informational object, which in fact is a quite interesting informational construction. It's a set of questions, which are sets of propositions, which are kind of dynamically construed as the propositions answering those questions. So formally, I'm going to take it as two entities of any level just put into a product. Okay? We'll get to the more formal semantics later, but it really needn't concern us right now, because I'm going to point out what the intuitive relationship is between these. This is a product type, just like in databases, where you create a product of two tables to make a different table. Okay, now if that's the case, then predicates themselves, if they select for one of these guys, can be complex predicates. Well, what the heck are those? And how many are there? Well, they're fewer in number because there are fewer dot objects. But if you can recognize that, then what you can do is, again, mentioning from the previous comment about recognizing such transformations and then clustering over the lexical sets for argument positions, you actually might come up with a better model, a better generative model for how to expect what types of arguments would exist in a particular position. All right, so motivate dot objects. When a single word or phrase has the ability to appear in selected contexts that are contradictory in type specification. So if a lexical expression alpha has the meat of these two contexts bottom, and those are both well-formed, then alpha is a dot object. So let me give you examples. So the first one would be something like a promise, or an allegation, or a lie. Okay, that these have actually been discussed in early action theory and command literature and speech act work from the 60s and 70s, obviously, Searle's work as well. As speech acts have this kind of dual nature, all right? Well, that dual nature is very similar to the dual nature that dot objects have. So let's look at this. I have an act and a proposition. A promise, allegation, lie. I doubt John's promise of marriage. What I do is I have an example for all of these. It's just an inventory. It literally is an inventory. But I'm going to give some classifications of it now. This is a speech act. That is interesting. It's a speech act. It's a characterization of a speech act. I allege, I tell you that you're alleging, I'm making a classification of what you said. So it's more of a kind of evidential than a speech act, okay? Now, I'd be really, really interested to see how these play out in different languages, because once you start having this look more like an allegation, like an evidential, then it's not going to behave like a speech act anymore. In any case, notice what I have here. What you doubt is propositional content. You don't doubt the rock. You don't doubt the computer, right? But you can doubt magazines. You can doubt Chomsky's latest theory. You can doubt Bush. You can doubt John's promise of marriage. Now, if you doubt Bush, what the heck is that? Bush is an individual, a proper name, this individual out in the world. Well, we'll get to those kinds of multiple coercions. John's promise of marriage happened while we were in Prague. Okay? Say this happened. This is the actual act. Okay? You can fix it. You can put a time to it. It can happen before other things. But the promise is something that once it's made, as an act, it has this interesting property. It's a proposition. It becomes forever. All right? So it becomes one of these abstract objects of Asher's classification. It doesn't have an event. You can't order it. Okay? You can have a state in the proposition. So this also, these data could be taken all the way back to actually syntactic structure. Actually has some, in 1957, of Chomsky, has some examples like this. Nothing can shake John's belief. John's belief is obviously false. Okay? Shake John's... Wait a second. Hold on. I changed this, and that's actually wrong. No, that's right. You have a state. You don't shake propositions. Okay? Shake relates to a state. And belief is obviously false. It's predicating something that has a truth value. I actually have better examples from the corpus. Attribute value. Now you're familiar with these because this is the temperature is rising example of Barbara Partee's. This is extremely widespread in the corpus. And as I said before, if you don't know what the implicit relationship is between the context within which words, lexical items, appear, you're never going to make those kinds of generalizations between the term, between the contexts. So you're going to end up making inductive generalizations about the way the language behaves. In other words, your generative model, okay, is going to be wrong. It's not, or it could be stronger if you made the associations, all right? So the temperature is rising, temperature is 23. See, I even modified it for Celsius. Well, you can't tell that, but that's obviously Celsius. You have act propositions, which I... Wait a second, did I go backward? You have event information. So I'm giving a lecture that has propositional content. Maybe null content, but it's propositional. Okay. It is an event as well. It's lasting an hour and a half. Massimo, do you have a question? That's right. So if you don't have a typed system, right, if you have a completely untyped lambda calculus, or if you have a weakly typed system with no selectional restrictions on your verbs, right, that would be like Montague. These aren't problems, okay? What's the big deal? But now we don't have to argue for the motivation to have richer context for typing. Did you have a question, Peter? You want to hold off? Or?
Because CLL for kind of there you have that asymmetry because you
for
can
which case
attribute value.
Oh, attribute value.
Yeah, because. When it is attribute, you can have the value expressed, right? Like, do some speed also be there? Like,
yep.
Like you can say ship's speed of 20 knots.
Yep.
20 knots, and there it is, its attribute and it gets its value expressed like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a good question. The question is. Or the point is that attribute value seems to be a little funny because you can actually express the attribute and the value together. And the attribute, in fact, seems to be something that is behaving predicatively or relationally in a way that you don't get with the others. Okay, so attribute value, I'll go into that perhaps in a little bit more detail later, is a little different than, say, book, okay, or lecture. But you do have such expressions with that. The lecture is about, okay? The lecture on semantics, right? You can get these argument structures to the event, okay? And in that context, what you've done is you've by virtue of the context, you've disambiguated the type for the head, which is taking an argument, right? The lecture on semantics, it's now an event, okay? But interestingly, you can still sort of select for the content. Did you read Dedekind's lecture on transfinite number, blah, 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 right? Well, you can't read an event. Well, we allow for that by virtue of something that I want to make formal, which is the selection of the propositional content, even in that context. And that's very similar to, by the way, cases that have been studied a great deal, such as drink a bottle of wine, okay? Bottle is maybe something that's a normal artifact, but when you put the content with it, you're actually constructing a complex type. So bottle of wine is actually kind of a dot object. It's an analytic dot object. Massimo, did you have a question?
Well, so I was then to continue on this. Then the
so the point would be then, so your view of coercion is a sort of filtering, right? So you take, you have objects, you essentially predefine all the types, the composing types, and then you can do coercion if one of the types that you associate with an object is the right.
That's right. In many cases, that's exactly right. It's a filtering, but not in all cases, because in many cases, there's no filtering to be done, right? You're actually imposing new structure.
Also, but are there any cases in which you sort of like start, there's an object which really is not of this type? So would you predict that it would not be possible to do it unless it's part of the lexical knowledge, then?
No, you can certainly get pragmatic coercions, or coercions that are expedient in a discourse, okay? But you have to have some constraints. So the lexical model will make certain specific predictions about that. Yeah, just the compositional model. So it's all a matter of what context you take, right? If you take the context to be that which is provided locally within the lexical entry, the frame, okay, then you're going to get certain behavior. Does that actually happen correctly? Yeah, to a large extent it does, but a better model would be to take a broader notion of context, which would be take the prior beliefs or maybe a discourse or topic focus information, things like that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Event human. You missed your last appointment. Okay? You miss events. You either make events or you miss events. Your next appointment is a Serbian student. Okay? You don't miss a student. Well, you do say that. Oh, I missed that student yesterday. What does that mean? It doesn't mean you missed them. It means you didn't intersect. There was no point at which there was an event such that you and the student were co-proximate, co-located, right? To put it in so many terms. So, but that's, in a way, kind of an event human object. Okay, Peter's comment. You can have argument structure with that. Appointment with, right? So the appointment with Peter is at 3:00. I have narrowed the interpretation so it can no longer denote an individual, okay? Right? Just like actually what we were saying, we were talking about relational nouns before class, and if you have a genitive which fills the argument, this is a work that, Volodya and Barbara have done, something like my, and you have a relational noun father, right, you cannot express the argument structure in the NP. You have my father, but not my father of John, right? Similarly for appointment in these kinds of cases. These are all over, and you see these are great for text because you go to newspaper articles and you get this ambiguity all the time. It's an ambiguity which is systematic or logical, hence I call it a polysemy. If the polysemy, I should just point out, is inherent to the object, then inherent polysemy can be modeled as a dot object. You may not agree with this particular formal characterization of how it should be done. Okay? Cooper doesn't agree with the whole thing, Robin Cooper's, but Cooper creates a record structure which acknowledges that there's a distinction between inherent polysemy and coerced polysemy, which I'll talk about later. So here, see, Mary couldn't hear the concert. I just couldn't hear it. The rain started during the concert. Again, it's an event. Start during. I think you're getting the idea. One of my favorites is lunch. I like foods and drinks. My lunch lasted too long today. I packed my lunch on Thursdays. Okay? You pack physical objects. Tea in the British sense. We don't have tea in the United States. Informational, physical. The classic dot object is an information object and a physical object. So, extending this, dictionary, diary, mail, email, mail, letter. Mary burned my book on Darwin. Mary believes all of Chomsky's books. Again, you believe or disbelieve propositional content. Organizational, informational, physical. You can embed them. The magazine, is this getting boring? The magazine fired its editor. By the way, for every object you're putting in here, you better have a realization in the language, in the syntax. And you do. The magazine fired its editor. The cup is on top of the magazine. I disagreed with the magazine, informational. Okay, put them together. And that's, of course, the problems of co-predication and zeugmas. I disagree with the magazine that fired its editor, which is on top of the, which is under the cup. Many of these cases are actually good. And what you see, that's a bad one, is that the co-predication has to obey the way you're projecting and exploiting the information. And that's one of the main reasons that I've simplified the system so that we can capture the co-predication and zeugma data that have exercised the community on this, the community that worries about this stuff for so long. Finally, we're getting to the end of this inventory. Probably the most prevalent is something that was studied by Edwin Williams and Jane Grimshaw many, many years ago, process result normalizations. And in fact, to that, all back in the 60s in transformational grammar, and they even made some of these observations. In fact, this is in Aspects, in 65. Linnaeus's classification of the species took 25 years. Linnaeus's classification contains 12,100 species. I checked it on Wikipedia, it really does. So that's a classification. Okay, that's some kind of artifactual body of knowledge. Okay, that is there. But the actual event took some 25 years. Okay, now, another kind of interesting thing is that to just drive it home, right? I know you're kind of, you know, you're on the floor like this and you say, okay, I believe, or at least for now, please go on. One more bit of data is that they behave differently with how you quantify the object of that predicate. Read quantifies over a dot. Steel quantifies over a physical. If you read every book in the library, and it doesn't mean you're reading every copy of Harry Potter. So say there are 35 copies of Harry Potter and so on and so forth. You read one copy, right? You're accountable for the information. You get the idea. Similarly, answer. If 30 of you ask the same question, and I answer it from Natasha, then I've answered your question as well, because it's the content. But to repeat every question, kind of more dealing with the actual asking of the question. It's a little dubious there, but there are other verbs like that. And I think that the intuition is clear. Okay, so I'm introducing the relationship, and I can type a predicate, such as read, as actually taking such things as its object. So read is a transitive verb. Internally, it's taking this dot. Okay. Now, if all you have for composition is function application, then you need to create as many lexical entries for an expression as there are environments it appears in. Okay, I'm just kind of letting it on the line. That's what I've characterized as weak compositionality. And that's what you have in the lexical model implicit in Aspects 1965 and any work done on Montague prior to, let's say, Dowdy, 79. To overcome this, many things have been done. The classic work that's been done in formal semantics has been type shifting. So Partee Root's classic Montague grammar work on type shifting, that was reference to ladder, type ladder, is in this camp. Categorical grammar uses this prolifically, and HPSG has lexical rules which do the same thing. An alternative approach, which I think is more in the spirit of not losing information, is what's done classically in GL, what GL started as, is adopted in one particular area by Moons and Steedman over aspect, and was adopted by Hendrick's work on types. Okay, so now let's look to the actual operations. We're going to have selection, accommodation, coercion, and using this richer type system. So let's get to it. I'm going to now go through the examples in some excruciating detail, but in order to be able to get to the excruciating detail of the corpus. So selection is going to be classic application, but with the addition of a richer set of types. Okay? Accommodation is going to be unification, that the type of function requires is inherited by the argument. Coercion is going to be this way of imposing information. There's two kinds of coercion. One is to exploit information that's part of the knowledge, the type. The other one is to wrap the argument with stuff that wasn't there before. Okay? That's classically what the packaging and grinding. A package and grind coercion operation, or type shifting, however you want to look at it, is a wrap. It's a wrapper. People know what I mean by wrapper? Yeah? Okay. So. Now, there happen to be two kinds of coercion as well. It's really important to understand this. There's domain shifting and domain preserving. Domain shifting takes the domain of interpretation of the argument and shifts it to something else in your model. So for example, I have examples. Domain preserving says, okay, you're coerced, but I'm keeping you within the general domain of interpretation. So domain shifting is, I'm going to take an entity, a noun phrase, and I'm going to make you an event, okay? A lambda controlled event. So, or begin. You know, I began the beer. Begin takes VPs or events, right? How can you aspectualize an event, a noun phrase? You can't. You have to coerce it. You're introducing, you're shifting it to a different domain of interpretation. All right? You get what I mean? Now, type shifting rules essentially do a swap. You say, okay, I've got an entity here, swap it out and put an event. The history or the legacy or the trace of what was there is gone. It's there in the actual application of the rule, but it's not actually in the semantic interpretation anymore or the syntax. Okay? Events can shift intervals. So if before takes intervals, as I think it should, then what happens when you get events? So you can have before Monday, before May, before 3 o'clock. Let's call that the basic typing for a temporal preposition. Well, before the party started, wait a second, the party started. Is that an interval? You can have before the party, I'm coercing to an event to an interval, okay? Before the party started, the starting is still an event that has to have an interval interpretation. So either way, take before the party, we went to the museum. Before the party started, we went to the museum, okay? They both have to be coerced to intervals. People see this? I doubt John. We had that example. Masmo?
Sorry, I'm just asking. Sorry. 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 So, but the case of the beer.
The beer, yeah.
So are you saying that the, because the form of type is
in, yep.
So it's dot type.
There's no dot here.
I thought that basically the beer would be a dot. It
could be, but beer, that's a very good question. Okay, so the observation is this a dot object? Is beer a dot object? Or is it a artifactual object, which is a different type of entity, namely entity that has some kind of function, purpose, okay? We're going to see the diagnostics and the criteria with which to determine whether something is artifactual or a dot, okay? And that's going to be, so in other words, here's the issue. Here the coercion is giving rise to an interpretation of an event. This is what I call selectional polysemy. Book has inherent polysemy, okay? It can mean its proposition in a freer set of contexts. So it kind of calls its own shots to a large extent, unless constrained, to be a proposition or an entity, okay? And modification can also be over either one. These types of event interpretations are always coerced. They're always coerced from a particular context. Okay? So, the bottom line is, artifactual nouns have event interpretations only by virtue of the context. Okay? I'll walk through the example, see if it becomes clearer. Okay? Because I want that to be very clear. Okay. Domain-preserving coercions are the classic count nouns. There's chicken in the soup. Or even NP-raising, the classic Montague type-shifting operation. Mary and every child came. Okay? People understand those two. But they're all over the place. There's natural artifactual. There's natural complex. They're all over. And those are the domain-preserving operations that we're going to look at today, right now. So first, let's look at function application with natural types. Is this readable? So function application, I start off with the simplest rule because you don't want to complicate your system unless you have to. Because every complication comes with a cost. If alpha is type natural and beta is type taking natural, a functional type of natural, then the composition of that is going to be T. And here's the natural type tree. Okay? So pure selection with a natural type is the rock fell. I have the rock and there's supposed to be some coloring here. No, no. See the colors. Excuse me. Sorry. Here we go. Yep. So I'm matching. There's no problem. I can go on my merry way. Okay? Straightforward? Function application with artifactual types, something that's got a T, like for example. If alpha is type artifactual entity and beta is a functional type, taking that kind, then the application is going to be straightforwardly T. An artifactual type tree is basically that. And I mean that in any operation, okay? It could be object, a prepositional phrase. So here I have the beer spoiled, okay? Spoil is saying, I need this artifactual guy as my subject. And that is a way of expressing it. And lo and behold, I have this type, and what I get, actually, oh dear, I didn't do it. Well, actually, so this matches this by accommodation. Okay, everyone see this? So beer has some function, and spoil is saying, I need something for a function, with a function. Notice this is different than a domain shifting operation. Enjoy something. Here, I mean, look, from a corpus acquisition perspective or from Montague perspective, beer, water, dog, you know, appearing in the beginning of spoil, the dog spoil, whatever, you know, it's all the same, okay? It doesn't matter. Here I'm saying, no, those are all different. Okay? Because, and that difference is going to indicate something else in the text going on. If you say the water's spoiled, then I bet you're going to get a purpose clause or a rationale clause. Something else is going to show up. In other words, there's a trigger. In fact, you get those triggers in the text. So that little bit of information has consequences elsewhere in the text, in the corpus. That's the whole point of doing this. Okay? If you didn't see that, then you're wrong. It's the wrong theory. Complex type application says, if you're complex and you got a verb selecting for complexes, great. You're happy. So that's John read the book. Okay? John is reading. Reading says, well, I want this physical informational object. Okay? You are a physical informational object. Great. Happily go on your way. Accommodation now says, okay, I'm going to take the most specific form, okay? So this is unification. And from an argument selection perspective, taking the most specific form to go on with your computation is equivalent to saying that I can inherit information from my supertype, right? It's the inverse relationship. Let's see how that works. So, Mary wiped her hands. Okay? I have a body part. Body parts are physical. So wipe says you got to be physical. Body part accommodates. So this selection accommodates the body part, and that allows me to go on my way to have Mary predicated of that, that predicated of Mary. Okay? That I used to characterize as a subtype coercion. Okay, but now I'm treating that as a much simpler operation. And the reason, you have a question, Peter?
Yeah, actually, could you go two slides up? It was about read selecting for the dotted types. The motivation for dotted types was the combination was different types of types of predicates. So how do you prove that a predicate needs a dotted type? Not, you know, certain predicates still take one part
of
the dotted
type,
right?
That's right.
So how do you prove that read requires both?
Yeah, it's a good question. So did everyone get the question? Why is it that read actually selects for the dot and not for the informational or the physical? And this is actually quite interesting. I'm not going to go into the detail that I think it deserves because it's so interesting, because you'll get bored. The quick answer is, look at data with adverbials and negation. Okay? The point is, let me just make this quite straightforward. If I write up here, can you see if I write big? So, sorry, I'm tempted to write big. Okay, sorry. So, that was a bad joke. So, if I say that a predicate selects for a dot object, what I'm really saying is that there are two relations implicated. So, if I've got a verb that says, oh, you're a dot A dot B, then what that really decomposes to is there's one predicate operating over A, another predicate operating over B. And they're always present in this. It's a sine qua non. It's got to be, okay? Now, if you can show that that's not the case, then you don't have the proper typing. With read, you can negate. So you can say, you can actually get the negation over either one of these. So in these cases, just imagine that one is it's over the physical. So what do you do over physical? You perceive it. The other one is over the informational. That's going to be understanding or something like that. If you can't see the book to read it, then this would be that case. If you can't understand the book, it would be that case. So you get those cases. And in fact, you get those in the corpus. I couldn't read that article from Pustiaski. Okay? I didn't have any lights on. That's not what it means. It means you didn't understand the content. Okay? I couldn't read because the lights went out, okay? So, now interestingly, the first interpretation, which I think motivates this dot, in the corpus goes with object elision, which I think is very interesting. I couldn't read, right? We couldn't eat. So it's more of a generic state by virtue of something. It's the ability. So I couldn't read because there were no lights. I couldn't understand, right? I couldn't read that article. So it's negating either one of those. Now, if that argument, that type of diagnostic, doesn't work for that predicate, then it's not adequately typed. Okay? There are other diagnostics like that you could find with adverbials. Classic stuff that's been done with the adverbial aspect distinction for Axiomsartner and stuff. Again, the methodology is clear. If the data don't work in your language, it doesn't have that type. That's interesting. Okay? Matho? You listen to a lot of books on tape, yeah.
Books on tape. And so, my intuition, I may be wrong, is that I can say, oh, I read the book, meaning I listened to it on tape. Are you saying that actually that's not the case, or is
no,
it the case?
No, that's true. That's absolutely true. That read now has its one of its original senses, right? In with books on tape, okay, audible.com and iTunes books, right? You actually now have the ability to read in the same way that Romans read, right? Romans were read to. And so Cicero would read the literature of the Greeks by having some slave read it to him, right? And that's exactly, you're having your iPod player play it for you. So that changes the semantics of the internal relations, the internal predicates. But it doesn't change the overall semantics of read, of book, for example.
So that would be a different type of the topic? Or I was just wondering if somehow physical listening on tape would actually still...
Yeah, I think you're extending the notion of read itself and then the notion of how you're actually perceiving it physically. Yeah, that's a good question, though. When I found that out about the Romans, I thought that was kind of interesting. And the crystallization or the sort of settling on reading being something that you do individually didn't come till about 1,000 years later or so. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So now, the first coercion we're going to see is natural to artifactual introduction. So that... Is this for me? My water? Sorry, I didn't mean to look for you. That's usually where the person is for the, you know. Okay, so in this case, I've got a natural kind, and Spoil is saying you need to be functional. So along comes this introduction, and I'm saying, for the context here, and now, subsequently, for all further discourse, I now have an object which is not just water, but it's spoilable water. It's very important. I now have an antecedent for subsequent reference, either subsequently in my sentence, in the adjunct field, or in the text. Water is now an artifactual object within this domain. It's very important. Is this clear? But there's also artifactual accommodation going on. Because Spoil says, I don't know, just, you know, something. It's got to be physical. And Liquid says, oh, I'm physical. So then it matches, okay? I just want to make that clear, because that's part of the formal operation. Now, natural to complex, going back to read, okay, we have rumors. Rumors are just propositional content, true or false, just like a lie, right? And they don't have to have physical manifestation. But once you put it in read, it has physical manifestation. You put it in an email, it's got physical manifestation. I read those rumors that you were spreading about me, okay? Now, that's important because once I say that, for the discourse, I now have not only a proposition, but physical content that has possibilities for antecedenthood, okay? That is very important for anaphora, okay? And... Mark Verhagen, Anne-Marie Manur, and Johann Boss did an early paper using this fact for some discourse accommodation work and bridging phenomena. Okay, now here's a complicated example. This involves domain shifting and exploitation. So, Mary enjoyed her coffee. I have enjoy saying, okay, you got to be some event, okay? So enjoy... drinking coffee, watching movies, reading books, tennis. Okay, tennis can be an event as well. And so the first thing happens is I do event. Can you read this? Is this readable? Yeah? I say, oh, you got to be an event. All right? So this is the introduction of the event. This is the classic GL coercion. All right? But then I exploit the qualia, like you were saying, Massimo. You take advantage of what's in the object type. Okay, I drink coffees for drinking, and I say, okay, well, look, I'm going to exploit this drink, and then I'm going to bind it into the event. Where is it? Right here. So this is the exploitation being satisfied. Okay. So then I've got enjoy to drink. Is it clear? So there's both introduction, domain shifting, and exploitation, okay, domain preserving. The police burn the book. Massimo, go back to that one. Yeah.
So,
are his comments okay? Should we vote Massimo to leave, or is it okay?
So, if you say Mary enjoyed her coffee, right?
Yeah.
It seems to me, again, I may be wrong, that you can continue saying it was hot and warm, but probably not that it lasted 5 minutes, meaning it took her 5 minutes to drink the coffee. Now, if you are coercing the coffee into an event of drinking the coffee, shouldn't that make the event of drinking coffee available for
us? Yes, it should, with certain provisos. And it's a really good question. This goes back all the way to, you know, Fillmore's data. John entered the house for 30 minutes, right? Which means, and this is different in different languages, right? He came back out, okay, after that. Okay, well, a normal predication of 30 minutes over enter doesn't make any sense. It's the wrong axiomsag, and it just, there's no way to predicate that, right, to have it durate that long. And similarly for this. So, and then Dowdy's example. I want a car on Tuesday. You want it now, but you want it to be for Tuesday, right? So there, it's kind of weird temporal anchoring of to have this car for Tuesday, but you want it now. So, because why would you express it? And you want it then too, but want is going to be persistent. So you've got this want interval. Want has an interval structure, and then having the car has an anchoring on Tuesday. And there's something similar going on here. You can enjoy your coffee for 20 minutes, okay? But you might think, well, that's part of enjoy. Okay, now your question is, if I'm saying there's an event here, and I didn't put in the event variable, but it's there, okay? You just say that's an event variable. Then does that have the same status as an antecedent for event binding or reference later as all the individuals here? And no, it's not quite as strong. The coerced event is parasitic on reference to the artifact or to the entity, but in a stronger way than if there were no event there at all. So that's why it's more like bridging, certain bridging cases than straightforward syntactic mentions. But that I don't know the answer to that. Your point is really well taken, because currently the theory would say, oh, it's there, it's in the discourse. It's a discourse variable ready for any kind of accessible exploitation. It's not quite that clear.
Well, it may have to do with the relative salience. There are lots of, you know, the same as the party marble examples. So there are some objects which are, you can infer the existence of, but they're not necessarily accessible because they're not salient enough. Maybe they're accessible.
It might have to do with salient structure.
Could you say Mary enjoyed the coffee, that took 3 hours, meaning that took 5 minutes in drinking the coffee? So with the, because demonstratives are a bit stronger.
Yeah, it might. It might. I mean, the data will point those out. I don't know. Yeah.
What about if the same sentence was very enjoying the coffee? Wouldn't that favor the event part of the meaning?
Get it again.
Wouldn't that sentence, Mary and John were enjoying their coffee, wouldn't that favor the event part of the of the meaning?
For subsequent anaphoric reference? So give me an example of how you refer back to it then.
I was not thinking of anaphora. I was just, I got stuck.
It does have salience, and it does have, you almost need it in order to get the right temporal interpretation. But Massimo's question still, I think, holds even for that example. Is it going to be a salient for other types of anaphoric binding phenomena? I don't know. Yeah? Was that still drinking, or what?
Well,
the rest of it.
I don't know if it was drinking to begin with, but did you say something like that? Did you break the drinking and the conversation that you had during?
Oh, sure. That's a good question. So, are there other? Okay, that's
so
well out of the scope of this.
Drinking, right?
That's right.
We had coffee yesterday.
No, you're absolutely right. So one thing that needs to be made clear, I'm giving the simplest model here, okay? I'm talking about models of richer compositional structure, okay? That's one that introduces discourse factors such as topic and, yeah, things that would come from anticipated actions, intentions, other things, yeah. So that it wouldn't have to be drinking. It could be a combination of things. It could be left unspecified. Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's a good point. The exploitation of the physical, I think, is pretty straightforward. Burning is looking for, in its non-metaphorical sense, I'm exploiting the dot structure because books can be physical, if it's a physical book. I mean, if it's on my computer, I guess I could burn my computer, but it's a different type of physical manifestation. I can erase it. You can't erase a book, a hardback book. So the modifications of the physical, the aspect of the physical, varies for the medium, clearly. But the point's still there. And believe, of course, is the same thing, is I'm referencing the informational content. Okay? Is this clear? Okay. Now let me go smaller. So what you see here is that the typology, and this is all really typology, for the way I presented it, is quite trivially, and I'm trying to keep it as artificial as possible, but motivated by data. Natural artifactual complex, I'm looking for a very, very defensible distinction in the typology of predicates that is completely and utterly dependent on the entity, on its arguments. So I've preserved the functional typing principle completely. And that's a good place to be. Now, that's not going to account for all of language, but it's a good fragment. So it involves, however, enriching the compositional behavior with not just function application, but accommodation and coercion. Okay? Unification grammars have accommodation. We've always had function application. Coercion is something that I'm trying to systematize as a very restricted, take advantage of local context of a type or introduce local typing. Okay? Unlike type shifting, it's lexically governed type manipulation, which is introduction. All right? So, what do you see in the corpus? So, take spoil. And Hanks will actually be here tomorrow to give his opinion on things. And one thing Patrick does is give his opinions on things. What you see is actually quite interesting. And we'll go and look at more data for every one of these examples. Spoil, I said, types an artifactual object, a natural kind. Well, that's not quite what happens. In the BNC, the British National Corpus, and this also holds over as much as you see this in the Wall Street Journal, and then in the American National Corpus, as much as I've looked at it, 80% of the arguments that I'm saying are artifacts are actually events. So artifactual objects. But, and this is quite interesting, the events are events that one would expect to enjoy, but you don't. Okay? So the same thing is going on. Or you might think, okay, this is a metaphorical sense. Well, if 80% of the usage of something is metaphorical, what does metaphorical mean? Right? That might just be its primary sense, another sense where you don't necessarily consider the notion of primary. Or it may, in fact, be the same sense with a more underspecified typing. So what's interesting, and I'll give the formal typing of this later, is that you can enjoy the dinner, the birthday, the view, the performance, the opera, the game, the match. These all have some expected purpose, telos. And I'm doing the same thing to that telos. I'm essentially negating it or blocking it or gating it, right? So if we look at, in fact, what spoil selects for something that has an anticipated purpose. Now, I didn't actually tell you what the product, what the result of the spoiling is. But the result of the spoiling is actually to take it away, right? But the fact is that these things have purposes, means that they really do have artifactual structure. And then if you say of a natural, the situation that spoiled the situation, then you're essentially coercing a natural event to having some purpose. So there's even coercion cases in that case. So I'm going to go, we're going to look at the actual data in the corpus. Now, let me just close up today because it's 5 till 1. I can't believe that. The difficult cases of selection that seem to disobey the principle of functional typing and seems to require some notion of co-composition if you want to maintain a notion of strong compositionality. And that's one simple example of open. So a couple things. If the derived verb type and the meaning is dependent on the type of its argument, and the actually, this isn't quite correct as violating functional typing. Let me give the examples. Okay, open in English and close. If the object is an entity, as in a door, a book, a computer, then when it's open, it can be used for its purpose. If the object is an event, then that event begins. It's an aspectual operator. A causative aspectual operator. So you open the conference with a lecture, okay? But you open a book, you open a letter, you open a trail for the summer, all right? It doesn't mean you go use it, it means it can be used. So it's interesting that open, except for the very physical, open your mouth, in what appears to be, you know, just a completely non-functional, non-utilitarian sense, actually seems to have a telos associated with it. Now, what we're going to see from the corpus is that even the cases of opening mouths or fingers or whatever it might be in the corpus are associated with characteristic purposes. You open your mouth in a corpus is typically a sign of being surprised or something like that, okay? Now, is that what the verb means? Well, no, we want to understand what the text actually is conveying, all right? So let me just close with one remark. What I've been trying to do is that the typing that we're going towards, we're trying to build, is intended to give you some reflection of what else is happening in the corpus. It intended to help you model the behavior of other aspects of the sentence. As I mentioned, expect there to be a purpose clause or a rationale clause. Expect there to be reference to such and such. Okay? And so that's what this type of typing allows you to do. It's not just presuppositional in nature, but it's also setting the frame, setting the stage setting for what might follow in a corpus, in the sentence. Beyond that, it's actually still satisfying the compositional principles for determining the meaning of the basic composition. Okay, let me stop there. Any questions? I guess we did them along the way. Okay, let's go to lunch. Thanks. I'll see you tomorrow.